chairperson, honorable members, good morning. I know that I'm not known as someone who deals with nuclear issues. Thank you for inviting us here today. I'm representing the DG, and I would also like to apologize for his absence. He's out of the country on official business. For the time being, I'm leading the delegation as the acting DG for the week. The members of the team are the chief director, Machubela, and there is Ms. Monale. She's the one who's going to make the presentation. And Ms. Mong, who's our deputy director. The basic issue for us to attend to today is the accession to the Convention on Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. This is also an instrument that shows South Africa's commitment to the governance of the nuclear sector. And Ms. Monale is going to make the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've already been introduced. My name is Elsie Monade, Director of Nuclear Non-Proliferation from the Department of Minerals and Energy. I'll be making a presentation on the Convention of Physical Protection of Nuclear Material, the CCNA, which is to agree to as South Africa. The outline of my presentation will be as follows. I'll have an introduction, objective of the convention, mandate of the Department of Minerals and Energy, the status of the CCNA in South Africa, the need for accession by South Africa, recommendations, amendments to the convention, and my conclusion. The CCNA, or the Convention on the Physical Protection of Nuclear Material, entered into force in 1987. Basically, the convention addresses the global concern about the nuclear security of nuclear material. Before the convention was adopted or entered into force, the security of nuclear material was a national responsibility which differed from state to state and was not subject to rising international standards. So there was a need for international communities to come together to come up with the convention that will ensure that there are international standards in terms of the protection of the nuclear material. And then this convention is therefore regarded as the major nuclear security convention. And then the key part to this convention, our guide can ensure protection at all levels specified in the convention. And it also covers the nuclear material used for peaceful purposes on their territory, ships or aircraft during domestic use, storage and transport. And this also includes international transportation of nuclear material. Then we go to the objectives of the Convention on the Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. The first objective there is to... the first objective there is to address potential dangers of unlawful taking and use of nuclear material. So basically would ensure that the material is protected and then it is used for peaceful purposes, and there won't be anything like theft or unlawful taking. The second objective is to ensure protection levels are as per convention rules on nuclear material in contact with party territories, ships, or during international nuclear transport, as I've already said before. The third objective is to establish measures related to prevention, detection, punishment of offenses relating to nuclear material. For example, if there is a material, we have to ensure that the material is well protected, and then there should be prevention that there should not be any unlawful removal of the material. So if it happens that the material is not well protected, then there should be a detection system which will ensure that people can detect that the material is not there. And then whoever is responsible for removing of the material should be liable for punishment. Then we come to the mandate of the GME in terms of the Convention of the Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. And then this one is in terms of the legislation in terms of the Nuclear Energy Act, Economic Policies of 1999. And basically we are concentrating on section 34 and 66 of the The section 34, basically 34A, to deals with all offenses that can be committed relating to nuclear material. For example, possession, use, theft, fraud, and also when you consider the issue of damage to nuclear installation or nuclear plant. So all these things are the offenses that a person would be liable to in terms of Section 34. And then also the other one is attempt, conspire with any other person, aid, induce, instruct, or command another person to commit an offense referred to in the above paragraph from A up to F. So if a person is convicted of any of the mentioned offenses, he or she will be liable to a fine or imprisonment for a period of up to a life imprisonment in terms of Section 62B, as we just said in the previous slide. Then we go to the status of the CCCNM in South Africa. South Africa signed the convention on 13 September 1988. And then it was not ratified. And then the cabinet has approved the accession of the convention, and then this was done in terms of section 231 of the Constitution of the Republic for us to get the parliamentary approval before we can accede to the convention. And then once the convention has been approved by the parliament, then the Department of Minerals and Energy will be responsible for the implementation of the convention requirements. Then we go to the need for accession by South Africa. Why is South Africa really need to accede to this convention? South Africa needs to show commitment to multilateral agreements. Let me know that at the moment South Africa is a member of the Security Council, so we need to comply in terms of the international or multilateral agreement. And again, the convention is considered to be one of the 13 counterterrorism conventions. And then state parties are obliged to ratify all the 13 conventions in terms of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1317. And then this convention, the CCCNM, is the last one, and then we have ratified all the 12 other conventions. And then again, we need to accede to this convention because of the recent announcement of further expansion of the South African nuclear program. The recommendations are as follows. It is recommended that Parliament approve the accession of South Africa to the Convention on Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. And then that the Parliament be informed that the Convention has been amended and that the amended Convention will be brought before Parliament as soon as approved by Cabinet. The issue is that the Convention was ratified in 2005, and then we need to also proceed to the new amended convention. And then the other recommendation is that some of the implications, some of the implications that there will be emanating from the convention will follow in the next slide. And then the original convention was amended in 2005. And then after so far, as of 6 February 2007, only 7 contracting parties had signed the amended convention. And then a condition is that for the state party to ratify the amended convention, it must be a party to the original convention. It's a condition which means that if we want to accede to amended convention, that we need to take it to the. And then at the moment, as a department, we are busy in consultation. We are busy consulting the relevant parties on the amended convention. In terms of the amended convention, it increased the scope of the original convention. It has much stronger counterterrorism focus that includes the issue of sabotage. And then the amended convention makes it legally binding for the state parties to protect nuclear facilities. Because in the original convention, only the nuclear material was considered. But then in terms of the amended convention, the facilities are also involved in terms of protection. And also that it will cover the material issues for domestic use, storage, as well as transport. The amended convention also covers the transfer of nuclear technology meant to strengthen the physical protection of nuclear material and facilities. Then I'll come to the conclusion. The ratification of the convention will not have an added burden to South Africa. And then it's an incentive to us to the maintenance and improvement of the nuclear security measures. As you know that we have the nuclear facilities, so I really ensure that the physical protection of the nuclear facilities is upgraded or is upstanding in terms of the convention. And then South Africa is already implementing most of the obligations of the convention. As I said that we the most our methane solution we have increased or enhanced the security of the nuclear material as well as the facility. Yeah, bon. Thank you.
The convention and the presentation thereof seem to be in line with most of the conventions we've gone through in the past, and in line generally with the draft of the IAEA in terms of security as it relates to safety and security as it relates to the use of nuclear for developmental purposes, but also with an amended version, it seems to extend to the facilities of nuclear as well. Well, the amended one will cross the bridge when we get there, but for now, I think we'll confine ourselves on the original convention. Remember?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two issues. If this is one of certain conventions or treaties or whatever been acceded, if 12 of the 13 have been acceded to by Parliament, why hasn't this one been acceded to by Parliament before? Why has it been brought to Parliament now? Was there any specific reason why it was not? If so, what are the reasons? Secondly, is this accession to the convention in any way a prerequisite to the state intention by government to enrich fuel? If so, in which way? I understand it's there was a stage where we did not enrich fuel, and there are basically two enrichment procedures. One is for energy purposes and one is for defense armament. And it is correct that we only intend enriching fuel for energy requirements and not for defense purposes. And have we received the approval by IAEA? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I really want to ask a question around the way some of the waste is being kept to sea and the dangers of other people having access to it. Are there any penalties that the state will incur when these sort of things happen? And I can name a number of things, for example, that it's hard, but when the low and medium level waste is in open casks there, and it's not really guarded, that area, anybody can get in there, as far as I could see the line. last time I went there. Also at Kuberg, there is a problem in the sense that the technicians have been negligent. For example, at one stage, sorry, the locks to a secure facility was put the wrong way around. The result that anybody could get into that facility and have access to dangerous materials. Somebody had to be held, I'm sorry, I've got a problem. Somebody had to be held responsible for those things there. And really, we are reaching a stage, as far as I can see, that the ponds at Kuberg must be very close to being to be full. And it needs to be now very urgently found secure place for keeping the high-level waste. And that is a major issue, you see, of what is prescribed there of deep-level cavities. You must find the appropriate geological sites and electronic equipment and things to retrieve and store those things. When I last time I spoke to Jill Council, they then confirmed for the first time they've been asked to look for a facility, but no progress has been made whatsoever. I'd like to know what is happening around those issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee. In response to the questions, I think one needs to just have indicate that last year, towards the end of the year, the Convention on the Prevention of Acts of Nuclear Terrorism was also brought before Parliament and was approved. And the reason why this one was left behind in the process is that when we started with the process of accession in 2003, the IAEA initiated a process of amendment, and we had thought as a department that we will actually come to Parliament with both the original convention as well as the amended one. And when the convention was amended in 2005, we then sought advice on, you know, the way to proceed, and we were actually informed that we cannot accede to the amended convention until we become parties to the original convention. So we are now in the process then of acceding to the original convention, which will be followed immediately by a process of then acceding in terms of ratifying then the amended convention. The amended convention is not yet in force. In fact, only 7 countries are currently state parties to the amended convention. And all the 7 countries are countries basically with very limited nuclear programs. And the amended convention has got certain implications, and I think a lot of countries are studying the convention very carefully to look at what changes they will have to make to their own security environment. In terms of the second question, the accession to this convention is not a prerequisite to any nuclear activity in a country, as it were. But I think that in terms of being a responsible citizen of the world, I think it would just it is in the interest of South Africa and all South Africans that South Africa becomes party to this convention. And I need to just state that in terms of the enrichment of uranium and so on, that you know, in our country's position is quite clear, and that is that any beneficiation of uranium would be for peaceful purposes. And at this stage, there are studies, desktop studies being done on the feasibility, you know, of such a move. And it is at this stage an intent, which intent would then be, have to be backed up by studies as into the economic viability of such a project, as well as weighing that economic viability with the need to ensure security of supply of nuclear material. I must say that there are studies that have been done which indicate that at the rate at which countries are building or are planning to build nuclear power plants, unless something is done, you know, they could be a shortage of you know, enriched uranium product worldwide in the next decade. So I think it would be, you know, it is wise for South Africa to start looking at what options are there, what can we do to ensure that we have enough fuel for Kubek, for example, for the next, for the duration of its life, which would be up to 2035. I think on the issue of physical protection of the nuclear facilities at the moment, we as a department are comfortable with the physical protection measures at all the nuclear installations in the country. There is a forum that is coordinated by the department, which includes all the state security organs, as well as the installation operators themselves, ESCOM and NEXA and so on. We recently had a visit from the IAEA, and we will be looking to actually add to our program other activities which will then further enhance our preparedness in terms of security. But this mainly relates to activities that will be undertaken in terms of physical protection in preparation for the upcoming big international event, the 2010 World Cup. And we will be getting assistance from the IAEA, who have also assisted Greece in terms of the Olympics. They are assisting China in terms of the Olympics as well. They assisted South Korea in terms of the previous two World Cups, and then they also assisted Germany. So they will also be assisting South Africa in that regard. I think the issue of the spent fuel pool at Kubek, for spent fuel for high level waste, the pond or the pool, as it were, the capacity was increased, and actually the is capacity now for the duration of the life of the station, which at this stage is 2024. And with the expected extension of plant life for about another 10 years, which is currently being planned, we would then have to look at expanding that storage. But at this stage, up until 2024, there is enough storage in the pool. There is also, what has happened is that also ESCOM has bought a dry storage cap, which would then serve as backup if something were to happen to the pool. On the issue of the Council for Geoscience and the Deep Geological Disposal Facility, I think that the policy, the waste management policy, has got the three options, that of disposing, yes, in a deep geological disposal, storing above ground, as well as the reprocessing of waste. Now, where the program of South Africa, a nuclear program to expand, you know, then the issue of reprocessing and recycling of nuclear fuel really becomes quite attractive. The price of uranium has gone up. 96% of spent nuclear fuel contains recyclable material. And we can then reclaim the uranium that remains in the fuel itself, in the spent fuel. So basically then your waste, you could also look at it as a resource, depending on the price of uranium at the time. So we would like really to look at the option of not just disposing of this spent fuel without actually extracting what would then be useful and also be then, you know, contributing to sustainable development through recycling. I'm not sure if I've covered on the issue of the negligence of officials. I think that matter would have been dealt with by the National Nuclear Regulator, as it were, because it's within the license conditions that ESCOM has got to comply with. Thank you.
Did South Africa sign the convention in 1988, in September 88, and then we are now in a process only after the amendment? Perhaps the question would have been, from 2004 till 2005, what? See, the problem of people who didn't have choice when they still had No, so I'm saying that gap, you know, between which I think perhaps it can be an addition to the members' question. That yes, the cabinet now has accepted, the process is on, but still we are responding to the original convention, not on the amended one from 2005. Why was it not clarified?
Chairperson, I think the cabinet approval was in 2005, as far back as that, and we decided to combine the two processes only from.
We've had that before. You've responded to that. Now what I'm asking is that yes, 2005, and that was after the amendment, isn't it?
Yes.
It was after the amendment. Now, I'm saying 94 to 2005. Is there any, from the department's point of view now, because I don't think that had the department, you know, taken this to cabinet, I don't think that cabinet would have had a problem. They don't have a problem even now that it was, you know, put forward, it was put to them in 2005. So I see that one, that because of the combination, then we have to deal with this, the original one. Why from 94 to 2005 was not taken up, precisely because the paradigm has shifted on UK with the new government, democratic government, focusing more on research and development with UK rather than other things which have been done in the past. I'm not going to go into it from the department's point of view.
Well, I think, Chairperson, it's also an issue of within the Department of prioritization of issues. One, we wanted to put in place, legislation that would then make sure that as we accede to the convention, we were able to then comply. The Nuclear Energy Act, was promulgated in 2000. Then the amendments, which then make us to comply with the counterterrorism focus of the Nuclear Convention, Nuclear Security Convention, was only passed in 2004. Now, I think it's just a question of, between then, it was a question of prioritization, one. But then, I think before that, there are other issues, perhaps, which could have made it difficult for the accession or for the ratification, for example, when it was signed in 1988. And I wouldn't want to speculate on those, but if one looks at the convention and its requirements, there could have been, before the certain processes were terminated, there could have been difficulty in terms of actually being party to the convention. There are processes that were terminated in 1990-91. And I think, before that, it would have been a bit challenging to actually fulfill all the obligations.
Okay, just to confess, I was asking you a question I know the answer of, but I just wanted you to. Members, I think we are just wanted to clarify ourselves. You see, there have been processes, the legislative processes, which is the one we are referring to in 2001. Going forward. Do we have any other thing on that? Come again?
Not on that, but I don't think I've been asked to talk
to you about that. You are not happy with the answer you got?
I ask really what penalties are there under the convention, you see, for example, that the state may also incur. So, for example, when locks are fitted the wrong way around, giving anybody access to a secure facility, that should be an offense. And as far as I know, nobody has ever been prosecuted for that. Similarly, also at fire pits where the material is in open trenches, where, as far as I could see, there were no guards to stop people from getting in there. There were people herding their sheep and so on, or whatever they were herding, to get into that area. Now that poses a danger, and I would want to know, is there a penalty that the state should actually incur for not having secured that properly? Or the leaking out of materials which have taken place elsewhere, because the rain has exposed the things, nuclear material has leaked out. Admittedly, medium and low level waste. So I'm really asking, are there penalties in the convention
that the state must incur?
Penalties.
I think there are two issues here. One is a safety issue, and which then is dealt with in terms of the National Nuclear Regulator Act. And issues such as leakage of waste dumps and so on would be dealt with in terms of that act. Issues of blocks the wrong way around within a particular facility would impact on the safety within the facility. Now, where the convention that is before Parliament today, that one deals with material which basically is outside the facility. The amended convention, which will come before Parliament, deals with a material that is also within a particular facility. So, in terms of penalties, there are penalties for offenders. Anybody who possesses material unlawfully or who causes someone else to possess material that they are not supposed to, or who gives material to somebody who is not authorized to receive it, then that person is liable to a fine as well as up to basically life imprisonment. And the life imprisonment really is looking at the consequence of some of those actions. I think that the penalty is on the state. In terms of the convention, any state that exports material to, for example, to us, they have to satisfy themselves that we have adequate security arrangements. For example, we get nuclear fuel from France. Then in terms of the convention, the French government, as it were, is supposed to satisfy itself that the fiscal protection arrangements that we have as the recipient of that material are adequate. And so far, fuel has been flowing from France to Quebec. And I firmly believe that the suppliers are convinced that the measures that are there are adequate. If not, they themselves would then be in contravention of something that they have acceded to. A similar principle applies to us when we supply material to other countries, such as the export of uranium.
Let's move on this. Let me put it to you on your views on the report, whether you approve or reject the report as it stands in front of you. Can I have an indication?
I move that we approve the report as presented to us.
Well, let me put formally then to you that as the report. Reports of the Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy on the Convention of the physical protection of nuclear material, tabled in terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution of 1996, dated 7 March 2007. The Portfolio Committee on Minerals and Energy, having considered the Convention of the Physical Protection of Nuclear Material tabled in terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution of 1996, and the explanatory memorandum to the Convention on the Physical Protection of Nuclear Materials, referred to it, recommends that the House approves the third convention. We will take it then that it has been approved and seconded. Thank you very much. Thanks. Acting DG and the chief. We now move to switch from nuclear to red. We are now getting a report from the National Treasury on the matter we've been seized with over a long period of time. I have in my list here Mr. Fuzile. Ms. Fuzile. Fuzile. That sounds English. The DGG Intergovernmental Relations with the National Treasury. I'll give it to him then to perhaps introduce the delegation and then receive a report from them. Perhaps before it, just to say that most of the people who have come before the committee here have pointed to this direction, your direction, on the issue of the legislative framework, particularly on the asset transfer, and they have said that they would have moved, specifically referring to Red One in the city of Cape Town. They would have moved at the Treasury, put in place this framework. Now, we don't know whether they are telling the truth or they are lying. We are about to discover who's saying what here. Thanks, over to you, Mr. Fuller.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Committee Members, thanks for the opportunity to present what we understand to be our role and the situation in relation to the ETI restructuring, but in particular with reference to the asset transfer framework. Perhaps I should take the opportunity to apologize on behalf of the Director General of National Treasury, Mr. Kanyako, who has just returned from France yesterday and could not be here to attend to other pending matters that he couldn't get me to. Our presentation will be in three parts, and we'll try and make sure that we go through it quickly so that we can deal with the specific matters which the committee wants to hear. But just in the first instance, we will talk through matters of law which underpin the way we are thinking and proceeding with the asset transfer framework, which is insofar as it pertains to the restructuring process. In particular, we would want to draw attention to, in passing though, the constitutional provisions that relate to fiscal matters, Section 214, but more importantly, perhaps, Section 229, which we understand from the communication that came to us in relation to the municipal fiscal powers and functions being which we're considering, you know, have come up, or issues have come up in that regard. But I'll come to the issue relating to that a bit later. Then the two schedules, 4B and 5B of the Constitution in relation to municipal functions, because they become important in relation to Section 229 and the charges that municipalities can impose on municipal services, electricity being one, or electricity regulation being one. Now the other legal issue which then becomes directly very important in relation to the restructuring process is the MFMA, which came into place midstream, if you wish, into the during the restructuring process, came into being or got enacted in 2003 with two critical provisions that pertain to the restructuring process. First is Section 14.6, if I quote it properly, which pertains to the need for a framework to guide or facilitate terms of assets between municipalities and other entities. But quite critically, something which probably does get overlooked, which we'll also be able to talk about, is the provision of Section 177 of the 177.3, which recognizes the fact that the MFMA came into being midstream into the restructuring process, which would have required the transfer of assets in any event, and therefore acknowledges that the processes of restructuring might require more might be more exigent than our abilities to set in place everything that would be required in terms of Section 40, and therefore provide for the possibility quite explicitly of an exemption insofar as assets that are transferred to facilitate the restructuring process is concerned. So that notwithstanding Section 14, which says that we need a framework, there is also within that same legislation a provision that provides for an escape route, in that regard. So that does become critical, because as you say, we also have been listening perhaps from a distance to the debate, knowing that the best option would be to have the framework, but also appreciating that perhaps 177 gets overlooked a bit, because it could have allowed for some speedy movement without the framework necessarily. Now, just a bit also in passing on the municipal fiscal powers and functions bill, which the original request has referred to, although the chairperson hasn't referred to now, so I'll be quick on it. It seeks to do two things in the main. One, it is to just deal with the most appropriate way to abolish RSC levies, which municipalities were allowed to collect previously, the metros and the district. And of course, set the basis for facilitating the search and the introduction of a replacement of that source of revenue to make sure that the fiscal capacity of municipalities remains unchanged or changed for the better. But at the same time, it provides for the introduction or changes to municipal taxes and charges, possibly as a charge on electricity being one possibility. Now, what our understanding is currently is that, in fact, in many instances, the municipalities do get something in the form of a tax or whatever one calls it, from electricity. And some of them have been very explicit and open about it. But it's not necessarily imposed quite transparently and explicitly, because the law doesn't require it, which in a way can be not appropriate for a kind of a tax and regulation process. Also. So what this legislation will seek to do is to kind of regularize, not targeting the electricity one by the way, but all municipal taxes, but it tries to, in a proactive way, set out a framework for regulating all municipal taxes and their introduction, because currently, as the legal system stands, a municipality or municipalities collectively would have to impose the taxes in such a way that they undermine macroeconomic policy before government, national government, whose responsibility it is to ensure that there is macroeconomic stability, can take them to court. Now, that's not quite a healthy situation, because court processes are costly, they can drag on, and the damage may be done by the time the process gets fixed. So what this legislation is seeking is to proactively say, before the tax gets introduced, there should be some discussion which is subjected to a tax in terms of that. But what I shall do now is to hand over to Wendy Fennell to just talk to some of the local government fiscal framework issues that might be important to note in terms of this restructuring process. And then TV today will talk to some detailed aspects in relation to the where we are on the asset transfer framework and what are the things that we're considering. We also have Joanne Ferreira, our legal person, just in case we need a service.
Government, then the funding approaches that's applicable to local government, and then lastly on end up with the involvement of the local government fiscal system, which we will then lead over then to TV, which is actually part of the local government fiscal framework and how it actually fits into it. Very important what we first need to acknowledge, and it's the responsibilities of local government is contained in Schedule 4B and 5B of the Constitution. And those functions are all intended, or quite a lot of those functions, or all primary basic services, that's all intended to improve the livelihood of citizens in the country. So it focuses on things such as water, sanitation, electricity, but all those things that's also important is community facilities and the like. What is also important is that when a municipality functions, it actually does in consultation with its community. What that means is that in a lot of municipalities, backlogs are different. In terms of services, such as water, in certain cases, a municipality would have addressed those backlogs. Electricity backlogs would be not that far gone. In other municipalities, electricity would be addressed, but water would be quite far behind. In other cases, particularly in the smaller municipalities, you will have a case where most services, the backlogs are quite substantial. So what a municipality is then required to do is to consult with its community on what services need to be prioritized and look at the funding that it's got available and target it appropriately. And that is the core of how municipalities make and function together. So it's got that whole vast range of responsibilities. On the one hand, some functions that municipalities perform is provided to the individual. In other cases, a service is provided to the community, and of course then you also get mixed services. In the case where it's a private service, and you can count water, electricity, sanitation, what a municipality often does, it charges its users charge. In the case of where it's a poor community, the equitable share or transfers from the fiscus is used to enable the municipality provide the service to the poor. But there's also a large range of services that's community-based where you can't levy a user charge. So what municipality does, it uses its range of funding options that it's got to its disposal, such as property rates and surcharges on electricity to fund municipal services. So that electricity surcharge that's applied in municipalities is an acceptable practice that's provided for in the Constitution. The only problem that sometimes happens, or often happens in certain cases, is that municipalities abuse that surcharge to such a level that it's actually got adverse macroeconomic implications or it hurts the sector, which is not the intention. So what needs to be done with regard to that practice is to get it under control so that it enables, on the one hand, that a municipality can actually fund all its services, or particularly the general services, on the one hand, but on the other hand, you do it in such a way that it's done responsibly so that the sector as a whole, in the case of electricity, that the electricity sector or industries within the electricity sector is not damaged. And I guess I touched on the fact that the local government fiscal powers and functions legislation is actually intended, or one of the issues that it will look at is that. And then also another issue I think that's important, and particularly when it comes also to waste establishment, is that we've got 283 municipalities, and they're vastly different. We've got 6 metros. They've got budget sizes that range between 3 billion to 18 billion. So they're quite large. They've got an average office population of 2.4 million per metro. And if you actually add the biggest 21 municipalities, it's 2/3 of the population that actually reside just in those municipalities. Also, another important issue is that those municipalities that actually use most of their own resources, property tax, user charges, surcharges on municipal services, to fund themselves. So they've not relied very much on transfers from the fiscal. And so those issues must also be taken into account, that they are able to borrow in the external market. They use often electricity to actually as a mechanism to be financially sound by collecting arrears on other municipal services. So electricity is integrally part of their budget. Then you go down to the smaller municipalities, where you've got the real rural municipalities. The smallest budget that you've got currently is a municipality with a budget size of 7 million. Compare that to the biggest budget that you've got of Joburg, that's 18 million. So that actually points out to the variances that you've got in municipalities. And both those municipalities got substantial backlogs that need to be addressed. But the way they go about it is completely different. Metropolitan municipalities can use a wide range of funding sources and even cross-subsidization, say, within the tariff, to also provide for the poor. Where the smaller municipality is fully reliant on the transfer or grants from the fiscal. And so what will happen with them is that they don't have generally the appropriate scope of sales to provide service efficiency, such as electricity. So amalgamation would definitely benefit them, but it will also benefit metros, and we'll get to that point as well if it's done correctly. And just the last thing to say is that the local government system has evolved over time quite substantially. The budget sizes of municipalities, originally in about 5 years ago, it used to be amount to 64 billion. In the 2006-07 financial year, it bumped to 132 billion. The grant, in addition to that, has also increased quite substantially. And that's all in acknowledgement that local government is responsible key sphere of government that's responsible for the provision of basic services. But there's a number of reforms that will impact on how municipalities function and how they finance. The EDI restructuring is just one of them. There's been reforms to the Municipal Property Rates Act, which will also change the ability of municipalities or certain municipalities to collect property rates, which would make them most probably slightly less reliant on transfers in future. There's also the reform possibly to the water sector that needs to be kept in mind. There's the abolishment of RSC levies, which some people also refer to. So all those things actually need to be taken into account when we evolve with the fiscal system. So our interest in this respect is often on EDI restructuring and how it impacts on the financial position of municipalities, and also to ensure that the financial position of municipalities are not adversely impacted during this process. And that is why some of the preconditions that you put into the MFMA is all intended to do that, to ensure that the municipalities provide services the most cost-efficient way, but also ensure that services and the community and service provision to those communities are actually protected. And that's one of the reasons why Section 46 has been brought into the process. But I'll hand over to Cyrilla.
Thanks, Wendy. Chairperson, honourable members, colleagues. I will deal very briefly with the asset transfer framework process and try and arrange and give you a sense of where we are. Firstly, let me deal with the process to finalize the framework. As you may know, the effective date of the MFMA was 1st July 2004. Due to that effective date was a phase-in period for the different categories of municipalities. And that is a three-year phase-in period for a number of different areas of the legislation. In keeping with the reform, respecting the capacity classifications of municipalities. In some instances, the lower capacity municipalities will become effective only on 1st July 2007. So that is an important point to remember, that the MFMA is in phase. Coming to the dealing with the framework, the framework deals with the generic as a transfer, not specifically to a sector. So at this moment in time, the work that's been undertaken largely dealt with the international research around September, October 2006. The framework started to draft with the various principles and issues that were raised around November, December last year. And the drafting stage in terms of various consultation and processes is now unfolding. In fact, January, February has been the period where we really contribute to further consultation. In essence, the updating of the progress and challenges, I think in order for us to get to a stage of a common understanding where things are, we have to look at firstly issues around principles, to ensure that the framework as situated in a generic way does address, and it applies to all assets in a municipality. So it's just not a specific type of asset, but a class. That is, you could call as well a challenge that we have to face. The consultation process has been quite extensive so far, and we'll deal with that in more detail. However, the challenges and the scope, one needs to look at in a sense where, at the moment, the assets owned by a municipality, whether encumbered or not, in terms of a loan agreement that links up with a specific asset that it had to put in place, has to be addressed. Those are the one key challenge. The next key challenge we can look at when we look at the scope is around the various servitudes that go along with that asset. Generally, assets are underground, so the land above the has to be registered as a servitude, and a whole range of issues. There are challenges there. Other challenges, both in the short term and the long term, relate to the inventory, the obsolescence stock, the various range of issues that are then applicable to that. Beyond that, there's a recording of agreements. To what extent do we record agreements between the different parties? Assets of a municipality is encumbered, what does it mean for the municipality, how does it affect its creditworthiness? As you may know, rating agents are the agencies that are conducting ratings on municipalities to give effective independence oversight on the fiscal state of a municipality. How is that been? So those are some of the real big challenges. Continuity of service is one of the other key challenges. Around ensuring basic services is provided in a continuous basis. Transferring of one part of an asset that, in order to provide a service, will require another part of an asset is also a challenge. So transferring an asset from one municipality to one entity quite easy. Transferring of more than one municipal asset base to one entity is a different dimension. Transferring from one municipality to many institutions is another dimension. So distribution of that equity in a capital nation is a challenge again. So we're actually drawing from you the difference in and this topic's off. I'll just quoted a few examples. We have to work through all those over the period. I want to perhaps flag that. The framework and regulations, this aspect has largely been dealt with earlier, so we can move past that. The issues, I think, here around safeguarding. Now, the applicability and exemptions is important. The appropriateness of safeguarding and the protection of the assets is another aspect that we may need to discuss. Now, the alienation, letting, and disposal of assets is a big issue. In some instances, assets perhaps have been leased, or if you want to transfer assets, do you do it via leaseholding, keeping the community, and the concept of community wealth is important. Many of the assets in a municipal environment actually been generated by the residents contributing towards that effort through the rates and taxes that we spoke about earlier. So maybe that issue, partly funded by national or others, but it does impact on the fiscal sustainability of that jurisdiction. Here we need to just be mindful of the balance sheet implication for our municipalities. And it's applicable to all municipalities we just speak about. I think, Chairperson, what is excluded from this current work that we're doing is around the bigger compensation issue for the assets for the municipality. As you know, in some instances, the extent of the municipal asset is quite vast. How do we make the funding for that municipality in what way? It's another challenging area. The issue about staff transfers, pension issues, labor relations, all that is excluded from this thing, dealing with the financial fiscal aspect of it. National and provincial entities, covered in terms of the PFMA, is excluded from this. And with the recent changes in the way that the structure may be unfolding, maybe we may need to address things further. Necessarily excluded from the municipal environment. Now, the development of the framework, I've spoken very briefly about, but what we did do, it took us at least 3 months to do research both internationally and locally, and we tried to then shape the effort transfer based on what we found internationally rather than reinventing the wheel. To understand the challenges and the emerging best practices is quite important. We are unique in terms of looking at the international research and the way that we are doing things. We found quite different, that's practical from other countries. Given the existing legislative and the guides that we'd like to put out, we need to review quite a lot of the other pieces of legislation that's already on the table and we've done quite a bit of work. In terms of consultation, I think it is fair to mention to the committee that we had met with a number of roadmaps in developing, including colleagues in the national departments, like provincial and local government, DME, DPE, ESCOM, EDI, one or two of the colleagues in there, certain and number of municipalities, Swan, Buffalo City, Mangaung, Cape Town, provincial government to see if there's a transfer of assets and how that impacts. So during the build-up to drafting the framework, we've done extensive technical work with other colleagues. So I think we want to ensure that we also bring on board any other restructuring initiatives that are underway. It may not be all inclusive at this moment in time, given the extent of the challenges. Other key considerations that are guiding the transfer. And when we looked at international research and other work, we looked at the valuation methodologies, the continuity of service to ensure that it is sustained. In the South African context, we have the unique nature of ensuring provision of a basic minimum service. In other countries, that's not generally there. So we have to look at that as well. So the context of what is coming. Various risk transfers and risk mitigation factors. In terms of providing guidance on the transfers, the valuation methodologies from the accounting standards that are currently in place, the old standards that were there, the new GRAP and the GMAP standards, they all talk to different valuation methodologies. So one has to work through the challenges around the different methodologies. If you work with one system and one methodology gives you one result, another gives you another. We also looked at the broader issue around mitigation of risk. Now, how do you mitigate risk? Do you do it at the national level? Is it supposed to be done at the local? Do you mitigate the risk at the local level? You want a local sustainable operation, organ of state at the end of the day. So we have to look at those as well. So those are some of the key challenges there. Asset preservation. Quite often what we found in international research is that once an asset is transferred to whichever institution, within government, within its own entity, outside government, the tendency is that those assets are not preserved in the state that they are. So there is those challenges that we also try to cover. The general process of them, I think it's important if we look at asset disposal. If it's a disposal of the asset, the challenges around how do you ensure that the municipality can still provide the minimum basic service to dispose of an asset in a way, because it has to provide it in the constitution and other law. I want to also mention that there is provisions in the system that require certain processes to be followed, such as 78 processes and other processes that we have to consider in developing these frameworks. So it's not just the MFMA and its provisions in the framework. So I'm providing to you the array of issues that we had to come to try and get here. What we hope to achieve in the framework is, of course, the definitions chapter, which largely will contain a number of definitions that will provide clarification, clarity on various issues around control, the classes of assets, encumbrances, which you spoke about earlier, external third parties, how do you define that, what is fair value, how do we go about ensuring that is what is historical cost, a range of issues. The next big issue that we probably look at in the whole range of details then provided is around how do we move into the area that provides a convention that everyone can work towards. Yeah. Because if we say it's a generic framework that we're working with, we have to consider not only a specific type of infrastructure, but the whole range of assets that the principles have to apply equally across. So those are further issues around valuation, the net asset value, the differences between the values and liabilities, are we bringing them on board, is it apportioned correctly, is it assigned properly. Just to give you a sense, municipalities in essence used to borrow a chunk, put it in a fund, and then purchase various assets. In a number of instances, the loan was still outstanding. If you transfer the assets, and not that land, you should know what happens to the loan. So I could just raise that as a net asset kind of value issue. Then we have fair asset book values and the historical cost. I passed just in passing on this matter because time won't allow us to go into all the details of this. But it really talks then, if you're transforming the finances and the financial reform, if you move into an institution outside of government, those institutions stop depreciation. Those institutions are in the accrual system already. In municipalities, we're getting there. In national provinces, it's not there yet. But these are the kind of challenges still are, how you treat depreciation. The next big issue is around how we deal with external parties. What responsibility do you assign to the municipal council if we have to deal with it, how does the municipal council take a decision? People have voted the council in to offer, takes a decision around its assets. What happens to the losses or the gains of that? That is not the council's per se funding. It is public funds to do it. So there are key issues here we've got to deal with, the loss and the gain and incorporation goals. How do you deal with the future budget if there is a loss? The community still has to pay for that in some way or the other to ensure that there is a balance in the finances and the balance. So various aspects, the reward, the risk and reward, and the other big issues around going beyond the entity is about, in doing this, how do we ensure a minimum standing is maintained? Preventative maintenance system. The committee and colleagues and members are aware of challenges faced with continuous maintenance and the system much about the service delivery. The content of the service delivery agreement is so critical. We have reviews on it. We've seen a number of agreements. Largely they're one-sided. They're not a balanced service delivery agreement. So community interests are important and various other aspects need to be addressed. Perhaps we talk about the security of death. Consul, in the event of an asset being transferred to a municipality, and we've seen, we just did some research on municipalities, there's something like 77 municipal entities now that were found through the research on the MFMA before we didn't know that. It was not reported. The question then arises further on, how do we get an asset if it's transferred and a municipality still has to provide a basic municipal service? Does it come back to the municipality? If you create a trust, how do you disestablish that? So there's dynamics here that we have to look at if we have to close the net appropriately in keeping with the different enabling provisions. Issue around parties not to profit from the sale, and losses, how are they reported, gain, how are they reported. Then, of course, the transfer functions to external parties, which then is outside the control of the municipality, once it's done. You've got to look at the competitive bidding processes involved within the supply chain system or not, ring fencing of the assets, to what extent do you ring fence things the assets given now. In a municipality, it's not like a department in government where you have one department doing one thing. A municipality shares their assets across a number of departments. I'll give you the example. If you provide water, you need to store perhaps some of your equipment, but that storage facility is used to store other equipment to provide other functions. Simple example. So there are plenty of issues around apportionment. How do you assign the ring fencing? What methodology? A whole host of issues here that have to be dealt with appropriately. And then, of course, does the agreements that have been handled then address and recognize both assets and liability? It's just not the one part and leave out the rest. Somebody has got to put the bill at the end. Of course, public consultation, if members look at the Systems Act carefully, there's a whole range of issues required around public consultation in developing of the IDP and beyond in executing it. So there are real issues we need to implement. Okay. I think that largely covers the issues. I've covered the service delivery, the financing costs of the agreements there are important and safeguarding. Chairperson, I think we are at a stage where we need to review and go and have submitted already for legal drafting. So an extent where we could bring it out for public consultation. Some issues actually address further process around cabinet, including to what extent do we go. The MFMA requires a mandated period for public consultation. It's written into the law, we have to respect that and follow that process. So there's probably another 50-60-day process there to resolve comments and then final regulation will be issued under the MFMA. Thank you. Minister, you want to?
us would wait for 15 minutes, come back and have this discussion on this presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the department for the presentation. Maybe one should assume that the department is aware as to why there was such a necessity for them to present here. And I was hoping that maybe the presentation will also be able to talk to us in relation to the pilot project on the red, that is red one, related issue. Maybe one would have to ask a few questions. The first one is the department aware and working in line with the plans of the government of the transformation of electricity distribution? I'm saying there are certain activities that have taken place around this transformation, and of which there was a plan which was going to lead into Red One being able to be implemented, of which we found that the outcry is on the side that this framework has not been produced in time. I was looking at your plan. Your plan started, I think that was slide number 7, if I'm not mistaken. Is it 7? Yes, your plan is starting from July 2006. I wanted to check, taking into account as to the issue of transformation. The planning, is it really around about the time that you received the information that there was the need of this framework? Because to me that is the starting point. But on the other hand is as to whether your plan, was your plan in line with assisting government to be able to accomplish the mission of saying Red One should be started to be implemented by the state? If it is not the case, has this been brought to the other stakeholders who were part of the initiative and the support of the successful implementation of this pilot project? The other one is, there is the issue of the framework, exclusions in the framework, like the issue of transfer of staff and the related matters. Are these handled somewhere, or by the time, by June, May, June this year, you say there is the framework. And again, there will be some that says the other exclusions have got to be taken somewhere else and a new process would have to start again. Is it running parallel that somebody is doing something about it? The other one is all this work done in-house? Is there a specific team that is dealing with that? Is there any beef up to make it a point that it goes along with the plan of the broader transformation? The other one is, according to your own assessment, we can understand the presentation, is there no possibility, has there no possibility that the issue of red one could have gone on without probably getting to the point where we'll say this framework has been approved and published? I'm looking at the legality, and that's how far from our coach.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in the introduction, we heard the issue of economic impact being raised. One of the key issues here, of course, for the consumers of municipal services and electricity in particular, are the different tariffs that exist within any given rate. And in rate one, I don't know what the variances were in terms of tariffs in rate one, but I'm sure that would have had an economic impact, some positive potentially, some negative in certain areas. But I just wanted clarity on how that impact would be reflected in a non-metropolitan area within rate one, maybe even on a category basis. Secondly, there were statistics mentioned in the presentation reflecting on the various municipalities' budget size budgets. I want to ask that those statistics be made available to the committee and figures so that we can have a look at them in our own research afterwards. And lastly, there was the issue raised of compensation. Now, we understand that the various parts of transfer that could take place, alienation, disposal, leasing. But I think the issue of compensation is vital to that. If people know what the options are for being compensated when they are asked or forced or whatever to alienate, dispose of, by whatever means, transfer an asset to someone else, and they understand what compensation would be, then I think you may have clarity on the issue and evoke needed response during the finalization of the framework, especially during the consultation phase, final drafting phase, and after the publication phase now comes into effect. Then lastly, there was a comment made about, you know, I would call it the succession of debt. If an asset is owned essentially because it was financed by a loan, then surely whoever becomes the new owner of that asset should carry the liability associated with that asset. If municipalities have incurred those loans, then whoever acquires that asset may need to acquire the loan as well. And I think there may be legislation on this, and I don't know the detail of that, but I think a finance expert would be able to tell you that that shouldn't be a problem. It could be in the common law. But basically, the debt that a municipal asset holds should, I think, in principle, not be an issue that would stop a transfer if such transfer is desirable. I want to leave it at that, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've got to be very honest here and just say I'm confused. Because I honestly believe that this process has been gone through. And now at this late hour, we're hearing all the reasons why not. It's a bit confusing. Because I do know most municipalities depend a great deal on the distribution of electricity because they derive revenue from it, and they're able to make up the shortfall of this other place. However, I didn't think it was to this extent. And then I also must say that I'm very suspicious now that we're being overcharged as ordinary people because of this need to charge in order to cover up their shortfalls. And I think, Mr. Chairman, there should be a serious, urgent need for us to come to a conclusion here. How are we going to settle this as soon as possible? And government departments should be working together in order for us to grow up here. And once again, I must say to this body after Mr. Pillay has spoken, you really got me confused completely. Thank you.
I think if you got Mr. Luca confused, it got me worried. But in any event, Mr. Chair, I think that briefing precisely indicates all the uncertainties in this process as of today. Not even as of 31 December, so you know, it just compounds the problem. But can I make the following remark? With regards to timeline, I agree with the previous speaker saying if the presidential project, which was to be initiated on the 1st of July 2005. 1 year after that, another department starts with it as a transfer framework. There's clearly no synchronization between the various departments. It's utterly unacceptable. It's close to neglect of your duty, quite honestly, from my point of view. This should have been done, if you embark on a process of RED, this should have been done in advance to ensuring that RED, in fact, kicks off, not the other way around. At the time you're asking the municipality to give over, dispose of, sell, leave whatever, its assets, you have to indicate on what basis it's going to be compensated for those assets. But when, how, all these issues raised by the presenters had to be indicated to local government as a whole. And I can assure you now, no Metro Council, no, not even University of Cape Town, no, not Johannesburg, would have acceded to these, under these circumstances, to a RED 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, or 6, quite honestly, yeah, that's quite true. Yeah. The other point I'd like to make, you know, if you look at slide number 22 on page 11, I find a bit of a contradiction. You know, I know there's a slight difference between control and ownership service delivery agreements and service authorities. But if you look at the way forward, RED as public entity. Now, public entity reports to the Department of Minerals and Energy, to the Minister of Minerals and Energy. It is not a municipal entity anymore. Now, that local government, whichever metro, whichever municipality it would be, loses control of the functioning of the provision of electricity. As far as I understand it, because it's a public entity, it reports to the Minerals Energy Department. If so, how is local government then practically expected to fulfill its constitutional mandate when the control over that function has been ceded to a public entity? Now, you know, you might be able to say, well, it's in terms of a service delivery agreement. But how do you affect the service delivery agreement when you have no control over it? You are constitutionally mandated. It is not a contractual agreement. It's a constitutional obligation, which is somewhat different from a pure civil contractual agreement. So, from my point of view, how does a little government, when it's constitutionally mandated, the control of that institution has been forwarded or been leased or sold to a public entity, ensure delivery standards, free basic services? It cannot. It cannot, except for a piece of paper, which is called a contract or service delivery agreement. What's the alternative to that local government when that RED does not fulfill that function? It has none, except if it's in terms of legal, of legislation, it has none. If it's in terms of a service delivery agreement, it can then call for breach of contract and then have that agreement cancelled. But practically speaking, it has no leverage over the control over that constitutionally mandated authority. Now, you know, maybe it's not a very simple and easy problem. I understand it. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it. But from a layman's point of view, and not a Lucretian, not an individual from Eskom or whatever. That's how I see that there's a problem at the moment, and I like some of your responses or reaction issues. You know, maybe I've missed something, I acknowledge it, I might have missed a whole chapter of whatever was happening, but, you know, I'd like some response, you know. Thank you.
Chairperson, first I would like to say Treasury has been part of this process. It is really surprising that they are now showing us their framework. In 2004, they were given a task to come up with that legal framework. Until today, they are having a legal person. I don't know what she's coming to, but they are having that person. And the person, part of delay what they are trying to do, because the language that they are using now, this person, is the same of the city, of the city of Cape Town, same language. If you can check, when they talk about this specialties and evaluation, it's here on the blueprint, when they are going to implement, particularly on the EPI restructure. So that is my question, because finance, SALCA, and other stakeholders, they were part of this process. But now they are talking as if they are the municipality. Can they tell us what, in fact, they are intending to do, particularly to this red one or EGI restructure? That is the question. Because this is text from the recommendation press. The phase of the blueprint does address the issue of asset transfer. Asset transfer should be valued upon transfer to the REST on the basis of relative depreciated replacement of cost or discounted cash flow. Now, we are expecting them to tell us that this from 2004, we were given this task. This is what we have done. So what they are presenting to us, I don't know. It's another delaying something, I don't know. Thank you.
I will give the pleasure to respond to the question. I'm just interested, when are you going to introduce this process to Parliament?
I should begin, and presumably begin with the chairperson's question. Whilst we wouldn't be certain about the specific date or even perhaps the month of introduction into policy, but once we have been through the review, in fact, I sort of, you know, having looked at the presentation myself a few times, I was struck by the fact that we used the word drafting in one of the slides. There is a draft framework which we want to have reviewed by a legal person. It's currently been drafted by policy people. Now we need it to be reviewed by legal people to make sure that it's kind of consistent with the law in terms of the way it is written. That in part begins to address the issue of what many members have referred to as confusion, because the sense that we brought is probably way too.
I'm asking a very specific question. See, you have not said anything. I am asking. They are telling me about the process of the review legally and so on. what have you put as a time frame for that? Because you cannot give legal people or whoever say to finish how we are going to take them.
Okay. I mean, I suspect that just because this claim is that once we have that framework by May ready and approved and accepted by at least the Minister of Finance in consultation with the Minister of Provincial and Local Government. There is a debate about whether, given that it would affect public enterprises or entities, should we, you know, seek concurrence, but it's not required in law, with DPE and GLE in relation to the electricity. But I'm saying, the reason I say that is because I mean, our aim is to, by May, June, once we have done it, got it through the approval process, to make it available for comment. Just like that. And if the processes work out faster than that, then it will be faster. We hope that they wouldn't work out later than that. So the target was going to be there. And that also deals in part with the question or the issue of the confusion we created in the way we communicated. It gave the impression that since the time we have been sitting doing nothing. But may I stress two things from our side, which I tried to communicate at the beginning, but probably not sharply enough. And it's a pleasure to emphasize this also, which is that the framework that's required in Section 40 is not for the transfer of electricity assets or electricity distribution assets. So the timeline for that framework could, in effect, be viewed as having nothing to do with the electricity distribution, the transfer of electricity distribution assets, because it deals with the transfer of assets of municipalities in their entirety. All assets of municipalities. Now, there's something that arises then out of that, which is the issue of speeding it up purely to address the electricity issue, which is just part of the business of municipalities. And of course you could tailor it and sort of end up with an electricity specific thing, which does not help municipalities, because municipalities have got more assets than the electricity related assets. So I want to emphasize that. Now, having said that, let me mention the second issue, which is very important directly in relation to electricity, which is that section, okay, which recognizes the fact that there is agency in relation to electricity, so that to ensure that the electricity restructuring process does not get held to ransom by the development of an asset transfer framework that deals with everything else, exempts electricity, or provides for the possibility of an exemption to facilitate the speeding up of that. That, I think, is very, very important. Now, I'm not aware of all the people who have been here who probably gave the impression that the framework would be a be-all and end-all. And the reason everything has stopped is because the framework is not there. But I mean, I'm just saying that there is that provision for that exemption. Now, we have been in interaction with a number of people, Red One and Cape Town included. There is even correspondence to the effect that, in fact, we should look at this exemption as the possible route to fast track the transfer of assets in relation to electricity. That we presented as one of the, I think, three or four options that we put forth. But look, this exemption could be granted, But I mean, exemptions get granted in many instances when they are asked for. But then we also, we thought that because there was the license fee and the link to the asset, we thought that, naively now with hindsight, that the license could be extended. And I suspect that many people, many role players, thought that the license could in fact be extended quite easily, in which case that could have also allowed more time for many things, including the possibility of developing the framework that deals with assets in their entirety, including the electricity one. But the first prize was ended there in the act. An exemption would be a consideration that would be given quite favorably. Now, I do not know how to deal with the question which perhaps I misheard, which would seem to suggest that we don't, as treasury, we don't function as part of government. I mean, that's not quite the way we see ourselves. Now, may I say that a lot of the stuff that Mr. Pillay talks to, which he will sort of follow up on, was not intended to say we aren't doing nothing because there are all these challenges. He was trying to show that given the time that we have had, these are the things that we have had to think through and research and find answers to in developing the draft framework that we have now, which will deal with the asset transfers more broadly. I must say, though, that there are other issues. I mean, the processes have not been stagnant. I mean, there are changes which probably are important to bear in mind in relation to this process. One of the questions that one asks oneself is, in relation specifically to Red One, or in fact any other municipality, and that partly relates to the question that the Honorable Speaker was asking, that the two types of transfers of assets probably have got very, very different things that go into them. A transfer of assets by a municipality to an entity wholly owned by itself and what it implies. Because in a way, it kind of puts aside a number of other things, such as, for instance, you can somehow skirt over the issues of valuation, get over the issues of compensation, because if you are going to own an asset, it's almost like you just ring-fence the business and you run it as a separate business. The issue of a gain or loss or something like that does not arise. Now, that is very different to transferring assets to a different kind of an entity that's going to be owned by more than one person or municipality, because then the tendency would be for each one of those who transfer assets into it to try and seek maximum value for their assets, because the assets will translate to a voting power or control or whatever you call it into the asset that they own. Now, the change that took place in October is probably not, it is not a trivial thing in relation to the speed of the process in relation to, for instance, Red One and the transfer of assets and so on and so forth. Now, the issue of exclusion, let me just touch on some of them, Mr. Pillay will deal with others. The asset transfer framework wouldn't, just by definition, deal with transfer of staff, because staff wouldn't be, precise. Now, I would suspect that, in fact, the transfer of staff wouldn't be a trivial issue. It may prove to be harder than the transfer of assets in certain respects. Now, the question was, who should deal with that?
somewhere in the restructuring, and GTI might probably have an answer to it. But it wouldn't be dealt with in this framework. Now, similarly, the issue of compensation, beyond just referring to the valuation, which is also covered in the blueprint, as the honorable member reminded us, will also remain thorny because the framework cannot say this asset is equal to this value. It can just set broadly how the valuation can be approached. Now, in the same way, by the way, that we see a lot of fighting in relation to land restitution cases, where the law says market value, and there are significant differences of opinion, protracted court cases, in relation to arriving then at that market value, because the owner has got one perspective of the market value, and the other player or players have got a different concept. So that will still continue to arise even when we have the framework.
Just perhaps one or two small areas that colleague has left, perhaps around getting more support to finalize the framework, the intensiveness of the discussions already with the separate departments, perhaps I brushed over it. We've had meetings and discussions with various role plays, different departments, want to get a sense of how far other issues have progressed, so we've not done it in isolation. The work has been throughout, a technical work as well as other issues that have been raised at the later point. I think it's important that the committee should also recognize that the time span, in fact, is a short time span to be able to do an extensive piece of work that is required and do it well. So a rushed job would have definitely resulted in something very different. Who knows what we would have sent out. And in hindsight, 2 years down the track or 3 years down the track, we may be coming back to this committee to plead for something else. So we'd rather ensure that the job that we put on the table definitely covers as much of the issues, and we will value inputs. I think the consultation process is so important, but we value inputs from the committee members as well to look at how we progress with further. The issues around budget size, I think it's just the content of the information on municipal budget. There's a publication that was put out by the Treasury, the blue document, the local government review that contains all the numbers in the annexure. It's also on the Treasury website. It was published last year around September, August, September. So it's available, all the numbers that you'd like to see, including some aggregation. However, it's not fully entrenched when you look at the numbers. You have to be cautious about just applying what you see for the sectors and the functions that you see. Has to be done in a more coherent way to get a proper picture. So when you review the numbers, which is available, and if you need a copy, we can give you one within the course of the week. It's no problem. So we have the kind of broader numbers where we've been quoting from. It's available. The other broader issues around the different types of alienation and disposal and leasing, those are all mechanisms that one could look at. The reason why we put it on the slide is not to say that it's not been considered. We're saying these are the areas that have been considered. So we have to look at all the kind of possibilities in an asset transfer framework. I think that was the major issue. For some of the details around you and I would know in a contract that there's a succession for the loan agreement, but in a municipal environment, and I was trying to explain that, is that it's not necessarily a pure loan associated with a specific infrastructure. It has to be apportionment of that loan to that infrastructure. And every municipality, in order to get this asset transfer right, would have to do that. I don't believe they have done it, having worked with municipalities for over 12 years now. They are not the legislature produced it. You can ask any municipality to show you their finances, financial statements. You can look at the apportionment issues, and you will see what we refer to. We're doing continuous research in that for the last few years to get them to move towards that. The new GAMAP-GRAP statement is translating that into precisely what we want to get right, a proper apportionment of the loans that were taken up. So precisely the issue about transfers can happen in a more effective way. I think my colleague also answered many of the other issues. I'm not sure whether there's anything left over yet from what I can mention.
If we can maybe respond to the public entity versus municipal entity issue. The decision to establish REITs as public entities was taken in October last year. And in terms of the PFMA and the MFMA, as well as the constitutional framework for delivery of services, that is a significant difference in terms of how the service delivery will happen. We have had a number of interactions in terms of how could we structure the public entity in such a way that municipal executive authority is still honored, protected, or respected. And I think that's quite an important discussion for the committee to have in terms of how do you actually facilitate a public entity without changing the constitutional authority of municipalities. And you can do that through a number of ways, in terms of how you structure your shareholding agreement, by having protected matters in respect of certain assets, etc. So I think from a treasury side, we've been quite proactive in respect of the October decision. And we've had a number of interactions with GME, DVE, in that respect. So I think from that perspective, although I think maybe just in terms of how it was initially put forward by the media, you know, people might have gotten the idea that it's sort of taking away the authority from municipalities. And I think that was not the intention at all, and that a public entity is actually also a good vehicle through which you can facilitate effective service delivery while enhancing local government's constitutional authority. And just maybe to say that, if I can just reiterate what Mr. Pavilion said, is that if you look at Section 177, it's been there since the MFMA has been passed, since the restructuring process has started. And in the beginning, the chair asked us, say, are we the guilty ones or not? We can just say the section has always been there. We've never received an application for an exemption.
There
was a request for exemption along certain other sections of the MFMA, but not specifically in respect of the asset transfer framework. So unless you have a letter that was sent to us, we haven't received it.
I think we should move on this, because you see, the thing is that the first point is exactly what you have raised. Last August, we had to meet the minister, with the minister. And partly because of the concern which has been raised by Redwan on the issue of the transfer and exemption, and because of the letter which has been written by Redwan on the issue of exemption, so there was. Now, when we raised this with the minister, he was very sympathetic, and we hoped that from the side of the department there would be an movement. That's one point. The second point relates to what the Honorable Schmidt has raised. In the State of the Nation Address of 2004, the President, he raised in relation to departments working cooperatively. The President pronounced that by the end of 2007, the last arrest should have been in place. Now, if we then go back to the first point I made, to say that this very objective is under threat because already the city of Cape Town has threatened that they are not going to transfer any asset until and unless there is a legislative framework to that effect.
the Sokir, it's not what the Mr. Fuzi has said, that with the benefits of hindsight, you thought the license could be extended. There was no need for that, extension. There was an exemption, as you have said it yourself. I don't think that there's been laxity on your part at present. You know, your very slides, which tells us that it's only in July 2006, few months from now, I mean, few months ago, that you started putting processes in place, says to us that there's been laxity. You have not taken this matter as a matter of urgency. And nobody has said, not even the people who came here, not even the city of, in fact, the city of Cape Town did allude to the fact that this impeded them in the issue, or on the issue of transferring of assets, the fact that there is no legislative framework. But from our side and everybody else, we never thought that that is a panacea on its own. There is EDIR process. That's why we have the Department of Minerals and Energy to come and explain to us as well on their part on this. We even discussed the issue of the Constitution last week. So we never saw this as a panacea, but we saw it as one of those urgent pieces of legislation. So I'm saying, you know, except the legal advisor. What's his name? Joanne, yes. Except Joanne, there is no reference on the processes of the restructuring program of government, whether it's a cabinet decision of last October. It's like, it goes back to what the Honorable Schmidt said, that it's like two parallel movement forward, and it will happen if it does. If it doesn't, it does not happen. It doesn't seem to be an issue to you. You know, we went to an extent of having the license lasting here with Red One, which is a very concrete example of this laxity. But I think we need to say that we want to see this speedy movement in your own, you know. We could have been somewhere else if we did not start July 2006 on this process. We couldn't be where we are now. We want to see this process moving in speed, as we have said, that by May, we would want to see this process. And we'll have to impress upon whoever is a stakeholder here to say that we want this speedy movement on this process, period. May we want it to be in the public domain, and we move. We get a sense that we are moving and deal with whatever challenges, because nobody, we have emphasized that, nobody has thought that this is a simple process. Not complex, not taking time. We understood that. The very involvement from the very beginning, we understood it's not. But we also understand that there are things which should have been done, which have not been done. So, we are moving forward. We think that your point as to the way forward of May is what would be acceptable, that we work on it. And it does give a sense of agency, because that's all that we've been asking for. So we felt it important to come here and interact with you and start the way of finalizing the program and the project, deal with EDIR, because we also feel that on that one there has to be a concurrent to take the movement forward. Well, is it going to get
challenges and problems from them as well. We'll take that and see how far we go. But again, we don't want this process to be delayed anymore. We thank you for your presentation. We'll be in touch with you and in touch with the process. We get the EDIR now, the minerals and energy. And after that, as we said, because of our commitment to the speedy moving of this process, we will, with the minister, as we said, go around provinces and engage stakeholders on this. Having been sure that at this level, all the departments are speaking to each other, and it was good that you mentioned that the DME, DPE, and everybody has been, you know, taken on board. Thank you very much.
Let's have the
last presentation today, and then see how we move forward on this. Department of Minerals and Energy. So we'll give it to the acting DG, and then he will give us the direction who will be doing what.
Chairperson, honorable members, today I have a very easy task to just introduce and then watch and listen to my colleagues. Thank you very much for the opportunity. We're going to make a presentation on the EDA restructuring bill. Since the bill has not yet gone through Parliament, Cabinet, we are not going to delve into the details of the bill. We are going to deal with the basic principles underlying the bill. They'll also explain to you the process that they're going to follow. The presentation will be made by Ms. Afane, Chief Director, Electricity. Is supported by Ms. Batun Jang and Maduna Ngobeni. Thank you very much.
Honorable Chairman and honorable members, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to give a very brief presentation on the restructuring legislation process. In the context that has already been outlined by my institution, that we have not yet taken this to our principal in terms of executive. Maybe I should say at the onset that we will keep our commitment to do this by the end of this quarter. So within a few weeks, we will be taking this to cabinet for their ratification, and then it will be introduced into the parliament. Might also be interested in terms of timeline. We're estimating that this being a Section 76 bill, with the experience that we have had with the regulation amendment bill, we're very likely to only come to the portfolio committee probably in the third quarter, obviously. In other words, around July, we will be hoping to come. I will focus on today, Chairman, just a background to reiterate some of the cabinet decisions around this process, and hopefully to give a sense of how the restructuring process will fit together. And we just had a presentation by Treasury which relates to the asset transfer. So what we're really saying is that this will form the legislative basis, but there are other processes outside of just putting the legislation in place that relate to the actual implementation of the rate. Cabinet decided in October 2006 on these issues. We're going to focus on the EI restructuring legislation, but just to recap, it will be fixed wall-to-wall rates, there will be a public entity, and there will be governing in terms of the FMA and the Liquid Regulation Act. ESCOM will be a transitional shareholder, in other words, they will exit at some point. DMP will oversee the establishment of the rates. DMP's agent, EDR Holdings, in that regard. We will deal with, there needs to be a strategy to deal with capital investment in the rest. There was a concern that you need to fund them and then make sure that it's adequately invested. There needs to be a roadmap to indicate how we're going to move from the current scenario to the future investment structure. We also need to develop an electricity pricing process. As to now, some of the high-level issues that we have dealt with, and maybe at this point I should indicate that in terms of the intergovernmental process, there is a task team comprising the four delegated ministries of DMT, PLG, National Treasury, and DME, GPE, National Treasury, and GPLD that has this, that convenes every at least once a month to deal with some of the outstanding issues. So I think please understand in that context that, for example, there will be a meeting next week to try and finalize some of the other issues that are still outstanding from a policy point of view. But we still believe that by the end of this quarter we should be able to take it to cabinet. Okay, the legislation itself will cover governance because that was a big issue that came coming out of the cabinet decision. How do you govern the rate in the context of the difficulties that relate to the previous decision? And we're saying here that there will be established head companies under the Companies Act. Obviously, there would be six of them, wall to wall, and public entity. There will be a framework and principles that relate to the transfer of the ESCOM side of the distribution business. I imagine having listened to the previous presentation, this is the key part of the process and complexity. It's one public entity. The ESCOM business will be ring-fenced along the six boundaries, having been defined as a distribution business, and I think in this regard it's very important to determine exactly which aspects of the ESCOM business are being transferred so that we can be separated out of the transfer. The governance of the governance and the principles that relate to the transfer of the distribution business in ESCOM or from ESCOM will also be set out. There will be a set of principles as well that relate to the transfer of staff, not directly but by reference to the current existing framework, which is the Labor Relations Act, for example. We make a provision in the law to reinforce the fact that those principles that you get here too. The issue of compensation, in particular when it relates to ESCOM, I think members can appreciate here there is some concern about how ESCOM business is going to be impacted, particularly as they embark on the new capital expansion program. So there would be a principle of how they would be compensated in terms of this process of restructuring them. And then obviously the date as to when or the conditions under which transfer will take place will be proclaimed by the minister. There will be provisions in the
regarding the rates themselves, the rates object, in other words, in terms of its memorandum, article, so on, some of the ancillary powers that relate to, you know, borrowing and so on, and just to complement, for example, the fact that the rates has to be formed and a capital investment in the issue that relates to that. There will also be provisions that relate to the winding up of the rate. So, and I think at this point, maybe one should refer to the presentation. I'm just not sure that this is where harmonization would have to take place as to what does it entail, you know, when the rate needs to be wound up and so on, relative to the asset class framework that is under development at the moment. We mentioned that there's a number of policy issues that the intergovernmental team is dealing with at the moment, which we hopefully will go through. And I just want to flag some of them for, you know, to give you a sense and appreciation of the difficulty. We mentioned the issue of governance of the REIT as a public entity. Cabinet has pronounced that it's cabinet. It would be a public entity. A REIT would typically consist of more than 30 municipalities with ELCO. In one region, and governance would be a big issue, but a public entity that has to be finalized. So this is the legislation itself. The asset transfer framework, I'm not going to deal on that. Treasury has already indicated the process is there. The National Electricity Pricing System, and maybe I should say in relation to this one that the department has set itself a target to complete the policy, the pricing policy, pursuant to the cabinet decision to do so by June this year. That would then allow the NERSA process to be concluded. In other words, there would be a policy and then a system would be developed as an outcome there. Tariff harmonization is another big issue. It's also in relation to the rate objectives that tariffs need to be harmonized. Saying that a framework as to how the tariff will be harmonized will be developed and never charges the responsibility. And then there was some concern, if you recall, about the issue of salary harmonization, for example, how that might adversely impact the finances of the respective municipalities, rates, and so on. And EDI holdings will charge the responsibility to reflect that. I have mentioned the issue of investment strategy. This is in line with the cabinet decision. And in that regard, the business case needs to be. There was no mention today of the municipal surcharges in that detail, but it relates to the municipal fiscal powers and functions bill, which is under development by National Treasury at this year. That would deal with the concerns by the municipality as to the financial impact of restructuring on them. Then obviously the actual rate establishment, in other words, existing as a public entity and so on, that is a National Treasury process. Treasury has already indicated what principle and process would be followed in that regard. Rate financing, needless to say, as a public entity, the legislation would have to, or rather, there is a policy position as to which way the rate needs to be financed, or needs to be financed over and above, or rather, fiscal transfers, and so on, or rather, in relation to options like fiscal transfers, and public sector finance, borrowing, and so on. And then electrification of free basic services, that in the context of continuous and seamless service delivery, that the rate must still be able to effect the provision of services without increasing that. That is a principle that has already been presented and that we just need to present that for basic information of the rate. The financial structuring, and I think one honourable member did raise the question about capital structure and so on.
policy position that needs to be finalized. For example, that given the outcome that the rate must be a particular, how do you then structure, you know, the equity and capital, you know, to end up with that? The environmental sustainability is that. Okay, I think this is, as far as we can take it, just to summarize, is that by the end of this quarter, we'll be able to present the draft legislation to Cabinet, which will then be certified and hopefully presented to the committee by the first quarter of around July, August this year. Thank you.
Just a second. One introduction that I forgot is we are also represented by EDI and NEPA. They also present here.
Okay, we only have one member, then we'll close after that. Okay. Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity. The presenter makes reference to the intergovernmental task team as a forum where many of the issues that we had in the previous presentation are potentially also can also or could have also been dealt with there. Is that correct? Do I understand that correctly? I mean, could some of these issues that the chair says correctly, National Treasury has been dragging its feet on, could they have been dealt with there? Could there have been more, you know, motivation given by the in that intergovernmental task team? And did you not get into operation there? That's what I want to know.
Maybe as you respond, you also need to clarify why is it that the process has not been introduced to an executive level? What are the hindrances to that effect? Because I think that considering the agency of this, as we said earlier on, that we see both these pieces of legislation going concurrently in ensuring that at the end of the day, what has been pointed to the direction of national government is not moving on this the framework are actually addressed.
Honourable Chairperson, if I take you back to the decision that was made around rates, the last decision was at the end of October. And I think in the past 3.5 or so months, there has been a lot of progress on both counts. The one relating to the intergovernmental process, there has been, I must say, a lot more cooperation by all members. As instructed by Cabinet, the four departments have, if you like, appreciated the urgency of the process, and these issues are being discussed at that level with the respective departments built up accordingly as to what their share of contribution to the process would be. And I must also mention that, you know, my sense is that the cooperation level is a lot. What does mean there is nothing untoward around that. It's actually very excellent, if I may ask. Relating to the question around why it has not been introduced to the intergovernmental, or rather to the executive, say that in terms of the law, it's precisely that we need to consult as broadly as possible first. The intergovernmental process requires all affected government departments to sit around and to do exactly that. And we believe that, you know, in the last, I think, 3 meetings or 4 meetings, it has been very deliberate consultations on some of these issues, and maybe 1 or 2 more consultations related to the outstanding issues would be sufficient. But
also relates to the problem that we have had for ourselves, that we had made a promise to our principal that it would be in the first quarter of the new financial year, of the new calendar year, mainly because when the decision was made at the end of October, it was towards the end of the year, it was very difficult to get the necessary process. In fact, I believe there was only one meeting last year. Most of the meetings only happened this year, and I think that it's still in line with our overall program that we will introduce to the cabinet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for you, you know, we all need to take mandates from our different various caucuses before we against or oppose, you know, or favor the bill. But just three issues which I think is overarching, which, you know, gives you a direction as to where the department is going. The first is it envisaged that membership or the rates will be compulsory for local government, all local government? In other words, will local government municipalities have an option to form part of the rates or not? Secondly, is it envisaged that the income stream from electricity will be via surcharges from electricity provision and not necessarily from dividends or both from the company as you intend establishing a company? And then thirdly, the issue of compensation, just those three issues. Because I think that broadly will indicate what local government might or might not do.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I can start with the easy one first. Envisage that the restructuring process is going to be a non-mandatory one. In other words, municipalities will not be forced to participate because of the constitutional issues that relate to that sort of approach, or constitutional complications that relate to that. However, having recognized that as a potential stumbling block, the intention is to provide for measures like incentives that would entice municipalities to participate. You know, having indicated to them or having convinced them that it is also to their or to the common good of everybody in the process. Regarding the issue of the compensation, as I already indicated, the matter of compensation is obviously one of consultation and negotiation. In relation to our proposal, I think we are almost at the verge of concluding the situation with or in relation to ESCOM, because much easier process. But as far as municipalities go, obviously we have in the legislation made provision for compensation, but as you can imagine, once the bill has been put out, there will be an opportunity for municipalities to be consulted and for them to also in fact, in that regard, we have written to all the municipalities soliciting their views as to, you know, what one could term a deal breaker in relation to compensation and so forth. Regarding the income that they would accrue to the municipalities, and I'm no financial guru, please forgive me, Chair, but the understanding is that there are certain principles, like, for example, keeping municipalities financially neutral in relation to their revenues. For example, the big concern for municipalities is that they will lose the income stream that relates to electricity. And therefore, there is a big consideration as to how to structure the rate in a way that municipalities can still sustain themselves on the basis of those income streams accruing to them. For example, and share without diverging premature detail, is that in the capital structure, of the rate itself, you know, if it's structured in a particular way that favors municipalities deriving a constant flow of dividends over and above the fact that there would be a sort of guaranteed
and the team. Thank you, member. Thank you very much.
Yeah.